Welcome to the Beer Driven Devs podcast, where your hosts, Matt Goldman and Liam Elliott, share their experiences and passion for technology, software, and of course, beer. So be sure to grab yourselves a cold one and join them for this week's chat.
Well, I guess let's just jump straight into it, Matt. There's so many questions I want to ask you about your trip away.
Yeah. Do you want me to kick it off?
Oh, I was going to use that as a very informal kickoff.
Okay. Do it again.
Matt, it's been so long. I've had so many questions I want to ask you about your trip away.
Yeah.
How have you been?
I've been good. Exhausted. Not that that's any different to usual. I'm sounding like a broken record. The trip was, what did I do? I went to Poland, to Jersey and the Channel Islands, and then to the UK and then back with a few stops along the way. Like, not big stops, but like I was in Tokyo and Helsinki and and it was a lot of traveling, but it was good.
Shit, that's big trip in such a short amount of time. I mean, one of the big questions, well, I was going to say, first up, like, it feels like it was so long ago since we last spoke because we recorded basically 3 episodes in one evening.
Yeah.
And then you packed up and headed off, and then I headed off for a bit of a break too. So it's good to actually get back and have a chat.
Has it been like 6 weeks, maybe longer?
Yeah, we've released 3 episodes since our last recording.
It's been 6 weeks.
Yeah.
Wow.
Tell me, how did your portable handheld device go?
Oh, I'm so glad you asked. Good and bad, right?
Yeah.
So first of all, here it is.
Amazing. We need a screenshot of that so people can actually see it.
I'll put some pictures to share. Is she not a beauty?
Well, I like it.
Turned out pretty well, huh?
Yeah. And you made two, didn't you? You said you took one over as a gift.
So that's the bad news, right? So this is the one I was planning to take as a gift. Sadly, it's a paperweight.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So just for a bit of background, I went to 3 places, and one of those places was Jersey. Jersey is where Mike lived.
Yep.
And Mike built arcade cabinets. Have I shown you his bubblegum Betty?
Yes. Yeah. When you introduced this project, you showed us that one.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's a kind of tribute to that. So I really wanted to take that for his family. And I was desperately, frantically trying to get that finished. Right. Literally, I was working on it the day before I left.
Yep.
And everything was coming together. And it was so hard. I had so many things go wrong and so many challenges. And I was like just in the home stretch. And I was just like, there's no way I'm just going to get this done in time. But like, I'm going to keep pushing. And like, it looked like it might happen. And then as I was doing the last little bits of soldering and putting things together, I shorted something and capacitor blew up on the step down converter.
That's right. I remember you sending me a photo of that.
Yeah. So that was terrifying. That was a very loud pop and a flash or a spark and smoke. And I immediately and very quickly and desperately started snipping all the wires. Cause that was like, it runs at like 6.2 amps.
Shit.
So that will kill you, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Easily. So yeah. So that was a bit of frantic. Now, unfortunately, that meant that I had to very thoroughly test everything to see what's blown and what's salvageable. The good news is like the chassis, like the case and the shell has come out really well.
It looks really good.
Yeah, I'm really, really pleased with how it turned out. Really, really happy with it. So I just need to do, I haven't got around to it yet because I've been so busy. I've been doing so many other things and I'm going to tell you about those as well. But I'm really happy with how it turned out. All I have to do is just do the testing. I've ordered pretty much a bunch of replacement parts because, as you said, I'm building 2. So I've got enough to do the second one.
Yep.
So either way, I will be able to put it together and salvage it. The problem is I didn't get to take it with me to Jersey and give to them. And I won't be able to send it because it will have, what will it have? Basically 25 volt battery in it.
Sure.
So it's a 6-cell lithium ion battery. So, and you just can't send them.
Any chance now, you could send it minus the batteries and get them to add batteries?
Yes. So that's the good part, right? That's the final little ray of light in this story. So my godson Chase is at university now doing engineering. So I showed them all the pictures and, you know, I said, look, I'm really sorry. I was hoping to bring this, but I didn't get to. And the short version is I need to finish putting it together so that I can give him the detailed instructions. I've already explained, he's already got some soldering kit. I've explained to him that he'll need a spot welder for the nickel strips for the battery, but you know, he'll be able to get whatever equipment and help he needs at uni. So the short version is I'm going to do that, get it all ready and send it to him without the battery, order some cells and have them delivered to him to where he's living at uni, and he'll finish it and he'll put it together.
Oh, there you go. Team
very
effort.
Very carefully, because as I said, that can kill you like easily. Yeah. But yeah, So that'll be a really nice ending for him to finish it and be able to use it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So other than that, I caught up with some friends. I caught up with my mum. I didn't get to do the travel plans that I was hoping to for reasons I won't go into, but I saw some friends and saw some family, and it was nice. And I've been so busy, and I had plenty of time during travel to work on other things. So as you are aware, it is July, which means it's Maui UI July.
Yep.
Have you seen any of the stuff that I've been sharing?
I've been following some of it. Yeah.
It has been an awesome year for Maui UI July. So I think I've done like 4 posts, maybe 5. So because I had plenty of time while I was traveling to work on them, but we've had submissions nearly every day. We actually had every day booked. There've been a couple of people that have not, they've had things come up, so they haven't been able to get their contributions out yet, but we've had other people that have submitted things that weren't on the list, and it's kind of taken on a bit of a life of its own because there have been some people that are not even on the list at all that have just seen the hashtag and sort of thought, here's something I want to share for Maui UI July, which has been really great.
Yeah.
But there's just so much good stuff on here. I'll just show off one of mine quickly. Did you see the Beer Driven Devs app?
No. I didn't see that one. When did that pop up?
On the 12th of July. So I'll just drop the link here now, and I'll put the link in the, we can put the link in the show notes as well. But this was for a client. I've been thinking about micro interactions in their app and thinking about how to handle downloads, because their app is a content-based app. And I came up with a bunch of different ways. And I kind of, in this post, I kind of go through my thought processes of how you get from the basic version, the least you can do, to something that's a way over the top option, but kind of works. Like, it works in context. You'll see. So there's some short videos there showing kind of how it works. But TLDR, if you just like scroll to the end and just look at that last video.
It's a big post. Yeah,
it is. There's just one video like right there near the bottom.
Yeah, casual chat with mates, 8 seconds, yeah?
Yep, that's the one.
Ah, just with those animations.
Yeah, instead of a progress bar, it fills up with beer, and you can see it's got like little bubbles. And then when it gets to the top, it foams over. So I changed it since then. I put a comment on here, and I haven't changed the video yet, but it kind of, the foam bubbles up from the bottom in that one. I've just changed it so it bubbles down from the top, which works a bit better. But anyway, I'm kind of really pleased with that. And then like, obviously the undownloaded ones are faded, and once that happens, it clears the fade. And I was quite pleased with how that turned out.
That's similar to, I think I've seen a post from you in the past about sort of the subtle perspective type.
The parallax.
Shifting, the parallax shift.
Yeah.
But just extremely subtle between sort of the foreground and the background.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, it's funny you should bring that up, because the day before that, a couple of days before that, there was a post from someone else in the community where he did parallax as well. And this is freaking amazing. So he did the same. I have seen this effect before, but he's just implemented it. It is absolutely amazing. What he's done is the same thing. He's done a parallax effect, but multi-layered. And instead of doing it on scroll, he does it with the gyroscope sensor on the phone. So as you tilt your phone, you get like parallax perspective of the image. Really, really cool. Really cool. And there's just a bunch of other, anyway, it's well worth a look. We can put the link in the show notes. There's some amazing stuff people have done with gaming, AI, all sorts of stuff. It's just really, really cool. So we can put that link in the show notes as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that's kept me pretty busy. Mm-hmm. And then one other side project, what is it? We got a week today before this goes out. I am planning on it's kind of already semi-public, but I am planning on making this public by then. So I'll tell you now, and I'll show you if you're interested in seeing it. I built a static site generator with Blazor.
Is this part of your workshop one?
No, it's built using, so I took the Markdown rendering engine that I built for that, and I turned it into a static site generator, basically. Okay. Yeah. So it's called Blake, which is Blazor Bake. And it's working. Not only is it working, the reason that I wanted to do it was I just got a bit frustrated with the way that static site generators work. There's too many assumptions. It's too complicated. There's config. There's specific conventions around, your layouts have to go here and your partials have to go here. Mm-hmm. You have to use some weird syntax, whether it's Liquid or whether it's some proprietary syntax. And I just thought, well, Razor is a templating engine. So what if you just have a folder? And in that folder, you have Markdown files. And in that folder, you have a file called template.razor. And the templating engine will just generate Razor files based on that template and that Markdown. And in a nutshell, that's it. That's how it works. It's got a bit more nuance than that, but that's it. Like, it's quite simple. So it can also work with any Blazor site. I've got a couple of samples ready. I've got a Tailwind-based blog that works. I've got a documentation template that I'm just finishing off now because I'm going to put the Blake docs in it. It's got a plugin architecture. So the docs renderer uses a plugin because, again, the idea is keep it very, very simple. There's no configuration. There's no complexity. Like it is literally just what I described, but there's a plugin architecture. So you can create a class library. And if your class library has something in it that inherits, actually, so the class library needs to have a specific naming convention. So it needs to be Blake plugin dot whatever.
Yeah.
So if you have a dependency that follows that naming and that dependency has a class in it that implements the I plugin interface, it runs a couple of methods. So there's a before bake async method and an after bake async method. It gives you access to the pipeline context, the generated data, so you can extend it and do all kinds of things with it. You can also like build complexity into your templates if you want to as well. Like the complexity doesn't need to be in the static site generating engine.
Because you've got the power of the Razor.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You just want to write some .NET code. You can literally just drop a Razor component in the middle of a markdown file and it just ends up in the rendered Razor. So you want to build a Razor component in your template and just drop it into your posts or your pages, you can. So yeah, so it's basically ready for V1. I'm just finishing off the docs.
Interesting.
Yeah. So that's what I've been up to. Like I said, I've been busy. And there's one more thing as well, actually, but I can't talk about that yet because I need to get some things signed off on it before I can share it. I'll tell you, though, we can't put this in the episode. Yeah. I drafted a spec for swap. Anyway, whole other thing. Let's talk about that another time.
Oh, good. You make the rest of us sound like we've been sitting around doing absolutely nothing for the last 6 weeks.
Well, I had a lot of time. So I was, don't forget, I didn't travel with my family. So I must have had 70, 80, I had about 80 or 90 hours of travel. So I had a lot of time to just sit and get things done.
Yep.
I said I've been busy.
Yep. No rest for the wicked, eh? So while you were traveling across the other side of the world, weddings and solving all the world's problems and everything that we've spent the last 20 minutes, half hour talking about, I was on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And we headed across to Queenstown, to New Zealand for a couple of weeks of skiing over the school holidays, which was pretty fun, except it kind of got interrupted.
Yeah.
And this is, I really wanted to talk to you about this one.
Yeah.
This is one I wanted to talk about today. Now, just before I was going to go on leave for the 2 weeks, we had an urgent request come across with a client that I'm currently working with. And it was extremely urgent. And they asked me how long I thought the implementation was going to take. It was a very simple integration project between two separate APIs, one that the company I'm working with owns and another one's an external API. And then, you know, I needed to build a little configuration layer in the middle that handled certain parts of configuration, exposed as a webhook endpoint when that gets called. It pulls data from the first API, based on the configuration, pushes data into the second one. You know, and looking at it, it wasn't too hard. And I sort of had a rough guess that it was going to take me about 2 to 3 weeks to get done. It wasn't too complicated and thought, you know, that's more than enough time for me to do what needs to be done. But because my holiday was getting in the way, you know, I ended up having to work. It ended up turning into a working holiday. So while the family were out there skiing in the Remarkables, I was down at the base station there doing all the work I needed to get done because I had already committed to getting the work done in 2 weeks. Now, long story short, I managed to get most of what I needed done in that time, but we still didn't get to release the project that we were working on. And so what I wanted to talk to you about today, Matt, is estimations, right?
Yeah.
So as far as I was concerned, my estimates covered my work and was reasonable. And I think pretty close to, I guess, within a small margin of error was quite accurate. The thing I didn't account for in my estimates, and this is on my shoulders, this is part of, you know, I think I am one of the ones to blame here with these estimates, is not taking into account all the other ancillary work that goes on around it. The work that involves working with the API team from our organization, who's based over in the UK. So there's time zone differences there. Expectations that the API was meant to do one thing and it didn't actually do what I was expecting and we needed extra work done, to legal and political concerns and issues and just general project management stuff that ended up making the project take so much longer that we actually missed the deadline that we were originally targeting. And so, as I said before we hit record, Matt, time I did spend out there working on my holiday, I probably could have spent just enjoying the holiday, coming back and dealing with all the actual implementation stuff after the fact.
Yeah, so, that's a shame.
Look, it is, but it isn't. You know, we learned a lot in that time. Like I said, it turned out to be a working holiday. It meant that you know, we were able to enjoy ourselves. I didn't have to worry about working without getting paid or anything, right? You know, the clients are still, I'm still working, so I'm still billing clients. So it depends on how you look at it, but there's positives and negatives to it. But what I wanted to discuss with you and I wanted to pick your brain around is, why are we so, I don't want to say so bad, but why do we get estimates so wrong? Like, what biases and what's the psychological reasoning do you feel that makes estimation notoriously challenging?
It's an interesting question. And the answer is because we generally don't actually estimate, we guesstimate,
mm-hmm.
right? If we were estimating properly, we would have formulas, we would have metrics, we would have calculations, we would have data that we would be basing those estimates on. But we don't, right? We use experience and we tend to sort of evaluate the problem, and based on experience, we make a guesstimate about, well, I think this needs to be broken down into these components and these tasks. And I think based on experience, a task of this nature takes roughly this long.
Mm-hmm.
On average, in this case, there's a bit of uncertainty, so I might bump it up a bit, but this is what I think it's going to be. And we get better at it, and they can often get pretty good.
Yeah,
but they're not scientific when we do it that way.
No, and I get that. And that's one of those things. And, you know, I've been trying to think about this because it's been a couple of weeks now. And like I said, my original estimates weren't too far from the actual required effort. And I think obviously if we're talking about a 2 or 3 week project, it's quite easier to estimate something of that size, that magnitude, than it is to estimate something that's 6 to 12 months long, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm not going to say, hey, look how awesome I was because I managed to nail a 2 week estimate down. But I think from my perspective, I think there's two kind of things to it, two parts. One, more than two parts, but one is, because I don't know about you, but when I estimate certain things and you break it down and you look at the various different tasks you need to take, I generally look at things going, that feels pretty optimistic. But if I do, like, you know, you might do put an estimate in to just build out a very basic domain model, you know, 3 or 4 entities or something very small, because like this project was not a big project, right? And I'd look at it and go, well, that shouldn't take more than a half a day.
Yep.
But in reality, once you actually get into it and you start to build things out and start to really think about it, you probably end up spending a lot more than a half a day. But there's a part of me that sort of, I find it quite hard to justify saying, oh no, that's going to take 1 to 2 days to get that 4-entity domain model implemented.
Yeah.
I find it really hard to justify that in my own head because it doesn't sound right. And, you know, when you're then trying to sell that to a client, it sounds like you don't want to rip your client off, right? And you don't want to overestimate because, you know, you don't want to rip them off, but two, they might not sign off on it and then you've let the work go.
Yep. Right. So there's your first bias. You were asking about what biases there are. Hmm. There's the big one.
So, but what is that? Is that the bias on you not wanting to overestimate, or you just feeling like it just doesn't feel like it should take that long? Like,
so I think
trying to narrow down what that bias is.
So we often talk about one of my favorite books, which is, You Are Not So Smart.
Yep.
I'm trying to remember which chapter it is, and I'm trying to remember the name of the bias. But he talks at one point about how operating on autopilot, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So he talks about how sometimes you know, you go to the store and you fill up your trolley and you go and you check out and you pay and you drive all the way home and you make all these decisions and all these turnings and these stops and these starts. And then suddenly you get home and you don't remember driving home because you haven't been paying attention. You've been thinking about something else. Now, when you've done something enough times so you actually are paying attention, but the conscious part of your mind is not paying attention to yourself paying attention, if you know what I mean.
Yep.
It's because it doesn't need to. It kind of knows it well enough to escalate when there's a significant event, which is a deviation from the norm. It escalates it up to higher executive function. Otherwise, it just basically deals with it based on familiarity.
Yep.
Why am I saying this? And I will need to look up what that is, that bias. It's in there. Why am I saying this? Because when you do a 4-entity domain model, because it's something that you're so familiar with, you do it on a similar process, right? So you're not paying attention to your own cognition while you're doing it,
mm-hmm.
because you don't need to. Right. So your higher executive function is not actively observing your workhorse brain getting on and doing the work. Right. Because you're not doing that, you don't pay attention and you don't notice the amount of effort and time that goes into it. And it just kind of goes by like that.
Yeah.
And that's what leads us to devalue our own work, I think. Like, I'm speculating here, but this is my hypothesis that I'm putting forward.
Yeah, it makes sense. I like how you've articulated that, to devalue, not just devalue your work, but devalue your effort.
Yeah.
Right. I'm not saying the work's worth less, but you devalue the amount of effort you're putting into doing something because it is so natural, rote. So easy, so rote. Yeah. I like that. I like that way of thinking about it.
But the other thing is, at this stage in our careers, we actually don't see a lot of value in that. That's the other thing, is we think that the value that we bring to the table is beyond that at this stage. The value that we bring to the table at this point is a bit more abstract, right? So problem solving, something a bit more strategic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think as a consequence of thinking about ourselves in that term, in those terms, we probably have that devalued, even internally devalued that aspect of our work a little bit. But the problem is, you're not charging your client for, well, you know, this four domain, you know, this four entity domain model is going to cost you this much, but the higher order abstract strategic components are going to cost you this much. You're just charging them, this is how many hours I'm going to spend on this, and this is how much I'm charging you per hour.
Yeah.
So if you're charging per hour, it doesn't matter what work you're doing. The monetary value of the work that you're doing is equal, irrespective of the nature of that work.
Absolutely.
I think that's the second bias.
Yep. I think you're starting to really nail it down. And that then I think ties back in my head to what you mentioned earlier about the estimates versus the guesstimates versus, I guess, the quantitative type estimation and the data-driven estimation, right?
Mm.
And I remember back many years back when I was at SSW, I estimated on a potential project that came our way, and someone wanted to build an application in the construction industry. Right.
Yep.
And this guy who was in the construction industry all his life could not get his head around the fact that we could not commit to a given deadline.
Yeah.
And that bothered me for quite a long time, and for more than one reason. But first and foremost, I've seen and I've worked for organizations that have gone under because they have committed to fixed price contracts. And, you know, they've obviously, they're underestimated, scope creep, whatever else is involved. The project basically sinks the entire company.
Yeah.
Right. I've seen it happen. And obviously that's not a great outcome there. But then the flip side is you fill out your estimates, but then your quote ends up being too expensive and you don't end up getting the work.
Yeah.
I guess the point I'm trying to make there is I've seen it, how fixed price quoting can be extremely dangerous from an organization point of view. You carry a lot more risk there. But the thing that really stuck with me was his point that this is a solved problem as far as the construction industry goes.
Yeah.
To the point that not long after I finished up at SSW, we actually had a massive renovation here. And when we went through that process, and I remember it because it stuck in my head, the builders that we chose had a fixed price that they were working to. And they had the fixed scope, and they made sure at the very beginning, they said, here is our scope document. You need to read this and you need to be 100% comfortable because that's what we're committing to.
Yeah.
We ended up going over budget. Absolutely. But as a client, we knew that those were additions and that was extra scope creep that we were asking for. And at every point along the way, they made sure that we were aware that any change requests went through the appropriate pipelines, got quoted out and got signed off.
Mm. So
I guess the thing that really gets me there is, like I said, it's a solved problem for the construction industry, but here in the software industry, we just can't seem to nail it down as much.
Well, what you just described is waterfall.
Well, yes. And I guess because we had the architect draw up the plans. The architect draws up the plans.
Yeah.
The plans go to the council. The council signs off on the plans. The builder comes in and then does it.
Yeah.
But we were still allowed revisions throughout within the scope of what the council would allow.
Yeah.
And we absolutely did. But I get what you're saying. It is waterfall, but
I mean, that's how waterfall projects work. You have a fixed price, you have a fixed scope, and you have a fixed time. And then as you progress through, if any changes need to the scope, you need a change process and it needs to be signed off and a scope change agreed and a cost change agreed. Yeah, it's waterfall. The reason we stopped doing it that way was because, you know, here's the difference, right? The reason we don't do it that way was because what you're saying is now we're bad at estimating time and effort to do things. But what we used to be bad at estimating was features and was requirements.
We couldn't nail the scope down, right?
Yeah.
And I guess the part that really sticks with me is, again, the construction industry have, and maybe it's because, right, there's when you're building a house or you're renovating a house, there is quite a limited scope.
Yeah.
Right. There are physical constraints that you're working in. I'm not going to add a helipad to my house, obviously.
Not with that attitude.
I don't know if the council would approve that. But, right, there's certain things that cannot
be done. Your son would.
Yeah. There's certain things that are just completely out of scope and cannot be done or just completely ridiculous.
Yeah.
So I guess in the scheme of the construction industry, the potential scope is a lot more narrow than what you would find in the software industry.
It is, but also the requirements are much better defined. Like, this is the thing, is you're talking about a relatively small scale project. When you get to your kind of three tower skyscraper site with a casino at the bottom, you think they don't get the estimates wrong? You think the scope doesn't change and the budget doesn't change? Of course it does, right? Because they do have to iterate and they do change. And you know, the budgets do, like, when, even, especially in fact, for public projects, right? So if there's a government or council project, they have to be transparent. I tell you what, like, just around the corner here, the new Central Coast Regional Library is opening in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
So they've had to be clear about that. They've actually been pretty close to budget. So I think the original budget was around 29 mil. And they're now saying it's looking like it's on target to come up at like 31 or 32. So that's not too bad, I think.
Within a margin of error, yeah.
Yeah. And also, I'm quite excited. It looks amazing. So that's cool.
I worked from a new library up here today.
Oh, did you?
And do you know what surprised me? Was the lack of books at the library.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not just that, but this is a whole different topic now, but it's more of just a community space.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of people there doing exactly what I was doing, just working there. They have three or four podcast studios that you can hire out. Yeah. Like, but they're more of that community space now.
Yeah. So that's what they're going for here. Like, you can look at the plans and what they're doing, and it looks really cool. And they are doing that. There's also like some public presentation spaces as well. Yeah. It looks cool. Looks cool. Just on what you were just saying though, where I used to live before we moved up here in Concord, we had a library there, which from the outside looked enormous. Look really cool. And I was, really keen to check it out. And there's this tiny little section of one floor that's books, and like, that's it.
Yeah. Anyway, small digression. But not that we do that.
But anyway, so I think what I'm saying is that as the projects get bigger and the timelines get longer, the margin for error increases. And, absolutely, those big commercial industrial projects, they do get it. And it's not that they get it wrong. They do have the same problems that we have. And like you said, with usually, because I think, unless I'm mistaken, and tell me if I am, I think this is an outlier. This is an unusual situation with this situation you described. I think usually as you said, when it comes to estimating like a few days or a week, those projects are easier when it's, than something that's 6 or 12 months, 36 months, 5 years, whatever. So it is unusual for it to not get right. But then the other thing that you said is that actually you did get it right, right? So your estimates were close enough.
So, and now this is the point I wanted to sort of more dig into.
Yeah.
Right. My estimates, and again, like I was in the position to say, I think we can get this live by X date.
Yeah.
Right. Now, my estimates took into account my effort.
Yeah.
Which is the part that did. What I didn't take into account, or what I completely underestimated, were the idea of the unknowns. Right. And they were not. So I guess, and I don't know if you're familiar, but there's like, they say there's two types of unknowns, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
The known unknowns and the unknown unknowns.
Yeah.
The known unknowns, I completely underestimated.
Yeah. Oh, the known unknowns.
And the known ones, right?
Right.
I should have known that there was going
Stop
to be
saying
these.
Known.
I should have been aware of the potential delays in what I was doing. And, if you go back to sort of agile estimation, and without getting into the technicalities and the story point side of things, but they talk about relative effort, but they use effort as a term of encapsulating risk as well as actual implementation effort. And it's meant to take into account these unknowns that can actually slow down a process. So the one thing that just keeps bugging me is why something was stopping me from acknowledging that when it was at that point of let's tackle this project and let's see if we can get this out the door?
Yeah. So I think there's two things that I can pick up on there. The first one is there's another bias, right? Now, I don't know who the client was, but I'm guessing it was a smallish business, not a major corporation. No?
Quite large.
Oh, okay. Well, then in that case, I'm completely wrong, because I do know that I at least have a bias towards, if it's a smaller business, you know, I kind of empathize with them and I want to help them out. So I tend to minimize that stuff more than I would for a larger client.
Actually, so let me just backtrack that a bit. So when I said we've got an API that is like an internal one, that's from our parent organization, which is quite large.
Right.
As an Australian subsidiary, which is the company that I'm contracting with at the moment, that I'm helping out, we are a small team.
Yeah.
And the work that we're doing, that I'm doing with them, is quite new for them. So yes, that, if we take that into account, yes, that side of it is exactly what you're talking about here. Is that bias to, I really want to help them. I want them to succeed and I want them to achieve and do something that they haven't been able to do before.
Yeah. So I think what you do, and when I say what I think you do, what I mean is what I do, and I'm assuming what you do, is that you subconsciously acknowledge and minimize that risk, because you've got enough experience to know that, yeah, there's some stuff here that could go wrong. There's some stuff here that could blow this out. But I also think I can probably deal with it and handle it if and when it comes up. So I'm not going to raise that. I'll just swallow it and I'll commit to getting this done. And I think that happens subconsciously because we want it to succeed.
I think you might have nailed it there.
Well, while you're mulling that over, I did say there was two things I wanted to address. So that was the first one. The second one is, we have actually spoken about this before, right?
Yeah.
Do you remember the burn down burnout episode?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You remember the core problem that I had that I was talking about?
Oh, you had deadlines that you were trying to hit?
Well, yes. So the real issue was that I was technical lead, scrum master, and actually doing delivery, right? So the estimates that I'd done were accurate for the work that I had to do from a delivery perspective.
Yeah.
Right? And they were more or less accurate for the scrum master duties as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not really as, not spot on, but close enough to not really matter.
Yeah.
But I completely underestimated the technical lead responsibilities.
Yeah.
Completely underestimated that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the same thing, really. It's like you think about, well, this is the work that I've got to do. Have I estimated this right? Yes. Have I accounted for all of my responsibilities with regard to the rest of the team? No, I've made an assumption about that, you know, without really diving into the rest of the team's responsibilities and capability level and familiarity level and all the other variables.
And that's why I wanted to talk to you about this.
There's my post-mortem of your why Liam had to work on the slopes.
And look, I mean, the thing is, you know, I shouldn't have put myself in that situation, right?
You want me to make you feel bad? You shouldn't have put your family in that situation. You can cut that out. I'm just being a dick.
Okay. In all transparency, though, the plan was to work 1 week on and a holiday 1 week.
Yeah.
Right. That was the entire plan. And it just meant that I ended up having to work twice, 2 weeks in a row.
Yeah.
But no, you're 100% right. 100% right. And it's, yeah, I think it's like these are lessons, right? These are lessons that I've learned that I probably should have already learned throughout my career beforehand. These are lessons that, you know, the team that I'm working with have learned, right? Because as I said before, we are a small organization here in Australia compared to the global organization. And this kind of work, they're not used to software side of the work, right? The global organization is the one that handles their software projects.
Mm.
So as a software project, this is quite new to them.
Right.
Which is part of, I think, like there was a lot of excitement around that. Yeah, like it was a project that was foreign. The software projects is foreign for this team here in Australia, and that's where I and my expertise, that's what I was brought on board for.
Mm.
And we're learning. As a team, we're learning. We're building up a team there. And, you know, moving forward, we'll make sure that these things, well, we learn from these lessons and there's less chance to have these issues in the future.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, you never eliminate these problems, but you get better at preventing them and you get better at mitigating them when they do happen. But they don't go away. Like, nothing's perfect.
I mean, a couple of weeks back, didn't you say that you found yourself in that same burn down, burnout situation?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Did I tell you what happened with the end of that project? Well, the end of my engagement with that project.
The second one or the first one?
The second one. the one that I was working on this year where I started to feel that.
I think you were saying like you basically called them up or you spoke to your boss and said, look, I've got to take tomorrow off. You told him like you had to take a couple of days off.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah.
You flagged it earlier.
Yeah.
You recognized it and was able to flag it ahead of time and say, yeah, look, I just need to take a break.
Exactly. That's exactly what happened. And exactly, you're right. I recognized it. I recognized the pattern and I flagged it earlier. I didn't, you know, not that I was feeling burned out when we had that conversation last year. I mean, it wasn't the catastrophic burnout that happens usually. But this time I didn't get to that stage. You know, I did overcommit. I didn't really overcommit, but it was an intense project and it was going well, but there was just so much to do and so much to get done. And I recognized it early. I saw the early warning signals happening and the alert got raised. And I recognized that I was just going to spend too much time working on the project. And I didn't collapse. I didn't have a meltdown. I didn't break down. I just recognized that the pattern, and I just carved out a bit of extra time and space that I knew I was going to need before I needed it, not after.
Yep. And that makes a lot of sense. So now I'm trying to remember, how did we draw that connection between not accurately estimating the required effort for the entire project to your burn down, burnout experience?
And so I was talking about how we often fail to account for the ancillary parts of our work and our commitments. Specifically, you know, when you're in a technical lead role, which, I mean, I'm guessing you're more a kind of fractional CTO, but that is effectively a technical leader.
Yeah.
So, you know, you are a technical lead. You are providing mentorship and leadership to the technical team. And I think we often underestimate what a demand on time that is. And that's why it is a full-time role. There are people that do that full-time, that literally are not hands-on and just spend their whole time mentoring and leading.
And
we forget that. We underestimate it.
I think you're right. But I'm just thinking about it too. I think it goes back to, you know, the bias you were talking about being on autopilot, right?
Yeah.
Where we, A, underestimate the effort we're putting in because it just happens quite naturally.
Yeah.
But then we also underestimate the stuff that we're not aware of.
Yeah.
Like, again, we underestimate those known unknowns because they're not on our radar because we're on autopilot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. The autopilot that I'm flying on is this is how we implement things.
Yeah.
It's not this is how you implement things and you manage this political environment and you deal with all these other stakeholders and you do all this other stuff because that's not part of your autopilot.
That's right. That's the stuff that you pay attention to.
Yeah. It's in your blind spot, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know where we go from there, but, you know, the project that I was working on, we've sort of taken a step back, reevaluated, and sort of come up for a breath of fresh air to start with, sort of regroup, readjust our timelines. And I feel a lot better about where we are now than where I was 2 weeks ago.
Good. Yeah. Well, glad. And how does your client feel?
Look, I think they're quite happy because they know that they're going to end up with a better solution because it's not going to be rushed.
Yeah.
We've been able to go back and use this opportunity to reestablish and confirm our requirements. So there's a lot fewer assumptions now because we're not rushing. So they understand that they're going to get what they want rather than what, you know, we have assumed that they want. So, yeah, I mean, the opportunity was there. Like there were semi-artificial deadlines. There was reasons for those deadlines, but they were not hard and fast, but they were very marketable reasons for them to be, you know, like there was good reasons for those deadlines to be set, but they were always going to be ambitious. And they understand that. But well, I think out of all that, the clients sort of realize it is a learning exercise. Like I said, this is one of the first times that they've tackled a project like this. So it is all, you know, it's not a lost cause. We're still going ahead. We're still got the work going and we're not too far behind, but we've learned a lot for, you know, how these estimates work, how we work with the greater team, how we work with the external stakeholders, how we work with the legal team and all the other teams that are involved. Because like I said, in Australia, we are a small company, but globally, it's quite a large company. And that's where a lot of the politics and the legalities and, you know, the privacy laws and everything else come into it.
Oh, of course. Yeah. So yeah, GDPR.
Yeah. So they, you know, a lot of their risk aversion comes from the GDPR. All of that is completely understandable. I get that. I don't want to downplay any of that side of things. And obviously privacy itself is a massive concern. We're not going to cut corners in that space, but it was a massive underestimation. But like I said, it's a learning. The team here have learned, I have learned, and we're moving forward.
Yeah.
We missed that optimal timeline that we were aiming for, but it's just one of those things.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you hadn't have taken the time out of your holiday to help them, they would have not hit that deadline anyway. So it was a chance that they didn't have.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it.
So I'll give you a bit of it. And, you know, I don't know if you want to finish up on this or if you want to explore this a bit more, but I'll give you a little quick story about a tangent on GDPR and privacy.
Oh, yeah.
So a client that I'm working for, and this is unrelated to estimates, but it's just a fun little story. And it reminds me of something Chris Simon says, which is there's always the main solution, which it's not necessarily the case here, but it was a good resolution to this problem. So a client that I'm working for recently migrated their monitoring and crash analytics platform. They moved to Sentry, right?
Yep.
And Sentry includes this cool feature that lets you take a screenshot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a flurry of work and I clearly wasn't paying attention and I approved a PR that added that feature. Now, this didn't go live. So this went public maybe a week, 2 weeks ago, something like that. So there's not many, you know, it's not really a big deal. But anyway, client got an email from Sentry saying your storage is filling up because there was a massive amount of UAT, internal testing, and there's a massive amount of people basically breaking it repeatedly and trying to cause errors and so on and so forth. And like, you know, and it was worthwhile work because we discovered heaps of unusual, unlikely, random, rare errors, and we were able to correct those. So that's good. But then it went live and I hadn't realized until we got this email, oh, your storage is filling up. So the product owner forwarded this to me and another dev and said, do I need to go up a tier on this product? And I said, well, you shouldn't have to. Like, we should have a look and see if we can figure out what's causing the storage to blow out, maybe resolve the issue. So I said to the other dev, can you have a look into this? And while waiting to hear back from him, I looked at another PR this morning to fix one of those outlier bugs that I mentioned. And as I'm looking through it, I see that he's changing the resolution of the screenshots to reduce the size. And I was like, oh my fucking God, we're including screenshots of users' apps. And I thought, shit, okay. So I had a quick read of the client's privacy policy. And of course, there's nothing in there. And this app operates globally. So, mm-hmm. you know, they're headquartered here in Australia, but they have users all over the world, including the US, including Europe.
Yep.
So, shit. Okay. So I raised it with the client. I said, look, we'll turn this off right away, but there's nothing in your privacy policy about this right now. Granted, the screenshot is of your app and it's a content-based app, the content being your content, not, you know, user-generated content. But there's a couple of things where it could be considered PII, one being the profile page. The other risk mm-hmm. is, what if there's a push notification from another app and that's captured in the screenshot? There's just too much risk. So I said, here's what my recommended path. And I gave them this long way of addressing it that was very, I think, ethical and professional. I said, first thing we do is turn it off. The next thing we do is we make it opt-in. So we have a consent screen that's shown. We explicitly get the user to allow it and we update the privacy policy. And I said, you know, at some point if you're planning to do a announcement about the new features and the platform upgrades, maybe include a mention of it in there. Might be burying the lead a bit, but that's fine. You know, there hasn't been a breach here. As far as we know, you know, the blowout of this storage happened during testing. So we can have a look. And if there's any affected users, we can email them separately and say screenshots were captured before we added this to the policy. Let us know if you want to see what your screenshots are and we can delete them, blah, 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 so on and so forth. So we're talking about this. Product owner says, do we need those screenshots? Can we just turn this off?
Yeah.
I'm like, well, yes. Should we not just do that? And I was like, yes, hard agree. We should. Like, we don't need them. No one's asked for them. Yeah. I'm so focused on solving the problem, you know, and how we deal with this situation. But yes, you're right. Just turn it off. We don't need it. So that's what we did.
So what you're doing is you're fighting the fire.
Yeah.
But the guy holding the match is still there, relighting it.
Yeah.
You haven't taken the match out of his hand.
If you think about it another way, you know, I'm standing there. You know, if you think about it, you've got a burst gas main and there's flames spewing out of it.
Yeah.
I'm there talking about how do we contain this? How do we build something around these flames? You know, repair the breach in the gas pipe or what have you. Meanwhile, product owners just walked over to the tap and turned it off.
Yeah. That's it. No one needs that gas supply anyway.
No. But no, nobody asked for it. They're all on electric. I've said it before and I've said it again. We spend so much time in this career solving the wrong problem. Maybe that's another episode.
I think so, but I think it is because I've got a whole rant I want to go on now. I'm already an hour in.
Are we going to do a Liam gets angry about shit episode?
No, not Liam gets angry, but I don't know about your job title at the moment, but it has been in the past. Mine is solution architect.
Right.
Right. You actually dig into it. You architect solutions.
Yep.
Right. So you come and, you know, for my business, I say, I've got on LinkedIn, right? I'm chief problem solver.
Yeah.
Right. Come to me with a problem. I'll find a solution for you.
Yeah.
And I really like to think that I don't spend time solving the problems the wrong way. I like to think that I take a pragmatic approach. And, you know, we had a discussion with a client, well, the client that I'm working with, the client of theirs, was it today or yesterday? Yesterday, when I was in the office. And they had a requirement that we just couldn't handle. But instead of just sort of saying, no, it's not possible, my brain's ticking over going, okay, well, what else can we do here? What other solution can we offer? So yes, I think you're right. And it goes back to the golden hammer story, right?
Yeah, maybe even the platinum hammer, but yes.
The platinum, but you know, we grow up, we're used to using our software development tools.
Yeah.
But that's not always going to be the answer.
Yeah.
And absolutely, to this client yesterday when I spoke to him, I gave him an answer that was not ideal, but it was more of a manual approach, but it would work.
Yeah.
And to get him over the line.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's where the value as a solution architect is, in that, yes, we look at the problem statement, we identify what the problem is, and then you've got your ideal solution, you've got your most workable and sort of the MVP solution.
Yeah.
And sometimes the MVP is more than sufficient.
Yeah. I don't put much stock in titles, but.
No, neither do I.
But that's why we're consultants.
Yep.
You know, solution architect maybe sometimes, but consultant always.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Look, I think you've answered a lot of the questions and clarified a lot of the thoughts that I've had around this experience.
Yeah, I think it was kind of a coaching exercise in that you already knew those answers.
I think so. I really do. But no, I think it was really good to talk it through, because now, you know, as I say, it's as clear as mud, and I'm sure I won't make that mistake ever again.
Until next time.
Until I make it again next time, yep.
Yeah. And on that bombshell.
I thought we're trying to move away from using that one.
Yeah, we just haven't come up with anything.
None.
That just flows off the tongue easily.
Nope. Well, again, thanks, Matt, for help clarifying that for me. I think that's it for this episode of the Beer Driven Devs. I'm Liam Elliott.
I'm Matt Goldman.
Cheers.
Cheers.
The Beer Driven Devs podcast is recorded and produced on Dharawal and Darkinjung land.
Sorry, I'm just looking at the transcripts, bleeping out your fucks.
Well, fuck that fucking transcript.
Yeah.
That's okay. Yeah, so